Welcome to Apropos of Something. We're on 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We air live every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, we're dishing with Priya Mahadevan about her unique brand of Southern Indian cooking, like the real chai masala, sassy cilantro chutney, and magical moong and garlic soup. Before cooking professionally, Priya was a political journalist in India. And as if that weren't enough, she's currently a local group leader of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense here in Charlottesville, and she's the author of two children's books. And we'll also be talking with Leanne Carver from the Maxine Platzer Lynn Women's Center on that nexus of social justice, mentoring, and education for students and the community. We'll hear about many of the center's endeavors, including the Men's Leadership Project, legal clinics, work around women and global justice, gender violence, and body image. If you like the sounds of these two, and who wouldn't, we have spoken to over 100 talented, scholarly, fascinating guests like these about everything from the rise of fascism to the life of bees, from Black Twitter to the refugee crisis, from soul food to how to make a balanced cocktail, and so much more. Check out all our podcasts. You can download them at 947wpvc.org. And my friend Nancy, are you there?
Ellen, I am here. I was just thinking, this last week could use an imbalanced cocktail, actually, as opposed to a balanced one. Yes, I am here. I'm here. And I was also thinking, if radio ever had closed captioning, which it won't, but I was thinking, what a nightmare your intro would have been with all of that fantastic Indian cuisine. I just would have wondered what that would have looked like below a radio caption.
Yes, you know? I think it would have looked.
Had to give them a heads up.
It would have looked tasty.
So yeah, exactly.
Were you talking about, there's so many things, of course, as usual these days, that the New York Attorney General sued the Trump charity over, quote, persistently illegal contact.
Yep.
Yes.
There's that. There's the I think we have found where the administration shines. They're apparently very, very competent in creating tent cities for imprisoning children instantly. You know, you can't fix Puerto Rico in about a year, but these tent cities, man, they are popping up all over the place, and they can't get on this fast enough, and that is, in my opinion, anyway. Well, it's tough. I mean, for me, it needs a cocktail. I can't forget North Korea and his fanboy crush on dictators.
I mean, yeah, I know. So the tent city, I heard that there are like 98 beds in a very remote place in Texas. I forget the name of the town, Tornillo or something like that.
I think it's Auschwitz, but yeah. Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
coming.
Right?
Yeah.
It's just, it's horrible.
Yeah.
The only thing I can think of to do is to vote, you know, to get people, one person who, you know, did not vote, and get them registered if they're not, and get them to vote. And speaking of that, well, I might save it for later, but Ohio did a horrible ruling,
yeah,
where if you haven't voted for 2 years, then you're off the voter registry.
Unbelievable. I know. I think they're trying it a couple others. If it's not exactly that, they're trying other discuss deplorable things like that in a few other states, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I did see that, yeah. And although I totally agree with you, Ellen, about voting and checking apparently that you're on the rolls no matter what, even if you voted last year, this thing with these detention camps and all the things I feel like we have, you know, well, I'm not the only one, but this can't wait. It can't wait until November. You know, I mean, it's maddening. What were these kids' nightmares? We're all responsible for the rest of their lives. So it can't. I mean,
Have you seen any action?
I hope it doesn't wait till November.
Right, you're absolutely right. Have you seen anything that we can do other than physically going there, and which won't probably do anything?
No, it's like the women, it's protesting, it's writing, especially, and I forget, you know, fortunately, I have Democratic leadership in New York, but obviously that's the problem, that it's not across the nation. So yeah, it's, you know, sending emails and calling it's our old playbook for Obamacare, you know, to get the GOP to stop just being worried and concerned, if that, you know, it's the
party of billionaires, millionaires, and the greedy, and the horrible, the deplorable, as you said. So it is worse than I think I ever imagined. All of this
don't
stuff.
You know, we're not even getting, even though it's
a slice of it.
It's exactly. I think the numbers are probably not what we think they are, and they're already way too high, of course. But I'm sure you know this too. This is the other part that they're losing track of parents to kids. You know, it's not even the ones that are lost that we know of. It's like they're giving each component like different numbers, so I don't even know if they're in the system. They're not even promising.
Well, any way you slice it, it is horrible. And I want to move on off that topic for now.
Yes.
There's a really unique opportunity in Charlottesville coming up June 21 through 23 called Unmasking Seville. Virginia Humanities African American Programs is hosting a three-part learning series at PVCC, what they call for an extremely candid and solution-centered dialogue about racism, led entirely by Charlottesville youth and young adults. But you'll want to live stream the panel Friday, June 22nd. It's called Backstory Breakdown because the event is sold out. So that is from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. You can tweet your questions. It's going to explore racism. A really, really interesting panel. Historians of slavery from Monticello, Zianna Bryant, the student activist, Nick Hyatt Walker, and independent journalist Jordy Yeager. So for more information, go to the Virginia Humanities website or Facebook page. And with no further ado, we have an amazing show right here today. Our first guest is Priya Mahadevan. Priya owns Priya's Now Catering and has created her own online food shop offering up soups, spices, teas, and chutneys. You may also have spotted her cooking up delicious dosas at her Desi Dosa stand at the City Market and Stonefield Market. Before cooking professionally, Priya was a political journalist in India. She's currently a local group leader of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense here in Charlottesville, and she's the author of two children's books. Are you one woman, Priya, or more?
What can I say, Ellen?
What can you say?
We just evolve as we go along.
Tell us about that, where it started for you.
When I first moved to Canada, people asked me about culture shock. And the one thing that I could say is, yes, there were two things that absolutely shocked me, that I had to do my own work, wash my own clothes and wash my own dishes. And the second thing was the speed with which cars drove in this country.
So explain that. So in India, you did not have to do that.
I did not. I was a privileged child.
That is,
and a family of nine kids. And by the time, I'm the youngest, and by the time my father had me, we were very established and we had a car and a phone, something, things that many families did not have. We were probably one of five people in that whole neighborhood that had those. Mm-hmm. So I grew up not knowing what it is to work for a living in that sense. But coming here, I have imbibed a lot of the power of hard work and being able to establish yourself on your own and, you know, do things that you're passionate about.
Mm-hmm. Really. And you really certainly have done that. So you started out, as you say, in India, and were you a journalist there? I know that you were.
Yes, I kind of rambled my way into journalism because I used to write a lot and I read a lot. My brother was visiting me in Delhi one time and he said, hey, you know, you write really well. You should submit it to some magazine. And I did, and they immediately invited me. I mean, it was very, it was one of those quick clicks for me. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to wait for too long. And then I worked in a magazine first and did a lot of interviews and wrote some stuff about local happenings. And then I moved on to a newspaper. That was really tough because I think, you know, they expected you to hit the road running. And I had no contacts. So what ended up happening was I lucked out and I got the chief election commissioner at that time. Mm-hmm. He kind of had a standoff with the press, and he said, okay, I'm going to give you my story. It just happened, you know. So we were in the president's Rose Garden for a tea or something, and I was asked to do these kind of things, which really didn't have a whole lot of journalistic capabilities involved.
Hey, Nancy.
So, yeah. So, Priya, with all of that political activity behind you, how did you wind up with, what was it about Moms Demand Action that you set your sights on that?
Moms Demand Action happened after August 12th for me. I have always been tuned in and feeling awful and about gun violence in this country. It's not like I didn't grow up with guns. I mean, I didn't have any personally, and I've never seen a gun. But there were guns in India, and we heard about people shooting each other randomly. I mean, but it's not like a acute, everyday happening. It's like an epidemic in this country. And August 12th, when we saw all those fascists walking in Charlottesville with, military-style weapons, I just said I couldn't just sit back and pray and, you know, hide away. You know, we all have to pitch in. I just feel like there's a big cloud of negativity which is looming over the U.S. right now. Mm-hmm. And we need all the positive energy we can. And that was my way of channeling my anger and frustration in a positive way.
So what are the takeaways that you, from that, the main points that we should know about gun safety and what people, either how people can get involved or...
Yes, we are a new group here. We started in November, but new doesn't mean we are not a force to reckon with. We have about 450 members on paper, and we have a good number of people attending our meetings. Like you were talking earlier on, Ellen, I think the big thing is to, for us, the big push for this year is to go out and campaign and make those phone calls to change the policies on guns and work with the candidate that is going to make us safe, make our communities safe. And, you know, we're not against Second Amendment rights. We just want common sense gun laws. And a background check, a universal background check, and, you know, banning of assault weapons are not out of the ordinary. They're just common sense.
Yes.
And as far as the schools in Charlottesville, and I know you have a child in a school down there, how do you feel that school, at least, is dealing with gun violence and gun safety?
Well, they had two lockdowns last year at my child's school. And that scares the pants of any parent, you know. That's not what they go to school for. And teachers are not there to do lockdown drills. They're there to teach. And, the idea that was floated around that teachers should be armed with weapons is the most ridiculous one. Nobody will want to send their kids to school if that were the case, because the teachers themselves should not be given this burden of having to protect their children. That's not what they're there for. They're there to educate. And I think, Charlottesville schools have a door that you have to get a buzz in. So I don't know, if you have a military-style weapon, no amount of security is going to change what the person intends to do, really.
Well, you take that, as Ellen's already alluded to, you take this side, the profession, all these activities you do, and one of them also is that you focus on amazing food at the city market. And tell me about that, how that all happened, that you took your love of food into a business.
Wow. So I come from a place from the southern part of India, which is called Pondicherry. It's like a boho chic French colonized place. And my mom was an amazing cook, but none of us ever took notes when we were growing up, because mm-hmm. things were just handed to us literally on a platter. So what we ended up doing is, when we had to do our own thing, we just had to carry the tastes on our tongues. And what I ended up doing is, after I had my third child, she was born 10 years after my second child, I just said I want to get back to writing somehow, and I started a food blog and started chronicling all the recipes that I was making. And that opened up a new world for me, a blogging world, where I found other people, like-minded people, and we just visited each other's blogs, got ideas. And there was a point when I would never let my family touch the food before taking a million pictures of it. But I think, you know, lots of people who came to dine with us just said, oh, my God, Priya, you should be offering it. And they had me cater some of the events. And one thing led to the other. And then I said, okay, let me try something at the market. And it's been 6 years since I tried that.
That's phenomenal. I love the descriptions of your food and their names, the magical moong and garlic soup, the sambar powder. They're so exotic. Something that seems like it might be really easy but delicious from your blog and your website is the black pepper rice.
Oh,
can
yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay. That's a very traditional South Indian thing, and we are all rice eaters in the South. So you want a recipe, Ellen?
Sure. It's just some bullet points and like where it came from and why it's delicious. And
actually, that is an offering which is very popular when you go to temples. They have what are called prasad. Prasad is just an offering, just like when you go to a church, you might get something like, you know,
fruits, a candle or
something like that. We get food and people, you know, pray for something to happen. And then they bring a whole bunch of something to the temple and offer it to everybody who's coming to pray. So I got my recipe from having it at a place. It's called the Grand Sweets and Snacks. I don't know if I want to give them too much publicity right now because they're horrible right now. But
that from the record.
Right, but they had this rice was it is oozing with ghee. But you can I have changed the recipe to make it less unhealthy.
Yeah,
but
ghee. I've heard ghee can be considered very healthy in
in moderation, of course.
In moderation,
yes. And then you just. Every time I go to India, which is practically every year, I bring back a little bit of spices and stuff like that, which I grind up and make my own masalas with. And I get my pepper from Kerala, which is the land of spice, and you know, mix it with the rice, hot rice and ghee, and or you know, olive oil.
I have a feeling it's the way that you prepare it that makes it so delicious, and also those spices that maybe we can't get from here that. Perhaps we can only get from your website.
No, you can actually get it from me at the market.
From you,
yes. But you know, I made it easy for people to not have to buy 10 different ingredients. Mm-hmm. I just put them together and make it like a spice mix so people can just add it and be done. Otherwise, when you follow recipes, there are like 200 things that you really need to buy. So it's just making cooking easier.
Thank you for that.
So Priya, what is always in your fridge? What are some staples of South Indian cuisine always in your fridge?
Not in my fridge as much as in my pantry.
Oh,
I have all my spices.
Okay. Where are these staples hidden?
Well, I have my spices. I have my dals. In my fridge, I actually have coconut, you know, frozen coconut, and I have yogurt. We are vegetarians, and we love our buttermilk and... Yeah, buttermilk is a staple in my fridge, actually.
So we're going to go to a hard break now. We'll be right back with Priya Mahadevan. We're going to talk about her children's books as well as her food. We'll be right back. We'll also be talking to Lee Ann Carver from the Women's Center. Stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Apropos of Something. We're on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. In a little while, we're going to talk to Lee Ann Carver from the Maxine Platzer Lynn Women's Center. And right now, we have the pleasure of speaking with Priya Mahadevan. I wanted to ask you just a little bit more about Moms Demand Action, and then also another initiative that you're involved with, if you could.
Yes. So lots of times people ask me how to get involved with moms. I just want to say that we are, you know, you can find me on Facebook and, you know, we have a secret group that we don't want to open up to public only because of security reasons.
Sure.
But we want as many people who can volunteer to campaign, to do phone banking, to spread the awareness, basically, of gun violence. And we had a bingo night, Wear Orange Bingo Night, that happened at Random Row, and we had a lot of people come and attend it.
Great.
So our big push is to create awareness and push for gun reforms. So we want as many people in the community join us as possible.
Yes, that is great. And then tell us about the Welcoming Greater Charlottesville.
Yeah, Welcome Greater Charlottesville was put together after the Muslim ban in January 2017, and we have been trying to come up with ways in which we can, you know, project immigrants and refugees as great, valuable, you know, additions to our community, people who are contributing a lot in many different ways. To this effect, we are we have raised some funds through Kickstarter to have a movie which is called... which is about immigrants and how much they have, you know, contributed to our community. And there's going to be aired on Welcoming Greater Charlottesville, Welcoming Week, which is an America-wide, it's a national week.
Do you know when that
September,
is?
September, yes.
We'll make sure to talk about that on this program.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Hey, Priya, I hesitate to ask you this, but I do want to ask you this, since you're bringing up the immigrant angle of your... life here. I know that one of the ways that Priya is now serving is in, you know, you have that stand in City Market, and I was just wondering, are people being receptive to your food there? Are you sensing anything different than you used to as you work in, you know, with people?
Nancy, I started life thinking I was an immigrant to the U.S., and then in the middle somewhere I kind of, you know, felt like I'd assimilated completely, and I didn't find myself feeling different. But then since 2016, I've come to see myself as an immigrant again. But I don't know that the perspective of some of the really close, wonderful people that come to the market has changed from then to now. They are most respectful, and they love the food, and they come there to know more about other cultures, I think, because many, many people who are working at the market are of from different countries. And we try to bring the best of what we have to offer from the different countries. And it's a beautiful place. So I have not sensed too much hate or angst in the market, really.
It's, if I hear you right, are you saying it's just, well, not that this isn't too little, but it's coming from our president, not from the community. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, from our president. And now we have the new threat of having Corey Stewart running against Tim Kaine. Mm-hmm. And that he's just another, you know, smaller version, if you will, of Trump. So we really need to get our guard up, and we have to really push for our for Tim Kaine to get back in power, mm-hmm. As well as for Leslie Coburn. We have to really fight to get some kind of kindness back in America, really.
Right, so Corey Stewart won the primary here, Republican primary, and he is up against Tim Kaine.
That's right.
Coming up. So, yes, he's a Trump surrogate mm-hmm. really.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, one of the ways that you are also, in addition to the other things you do, is that you are, in your way, in my view, you know, promoting multiculturalism with your kids' books. So tell us about this first book, Princesses Only Wear Putaputas. What was that? How did that come to be?
Oh, thank you. So Princesses Only Wear Putaputas was the second book I wrote. Feifei Says No was the first one I wrote. But then, you know, logistics being what they are and superstitions being what they are, my family decided that I shouldn't start a book that says no first. So, but the whole idea, you're absolutely right. Many families in this country straddle two cultures. Mine is definitely one of those. And I like to, you know, I wanted to share with the American community that I live in the beauty of my culture, because I have imbibed a lot of things from this country, like standing up for myself, being my children's advocate, so many things that I would have never done if I had to be in India. So I just wanted to give back. This is my way of giving back. And I think it was received really well. Initially, when I went through the traditional press publishers, I just got the usual, this is a multicultural book, maybe you should try and so-and-so and so-and-so. The review was good, but they were not really willing to take on something very different. So I had a local agent who said, You should get a crowdfunding going with this. And she put me onto Kickstarter, and we got more than we needed for two books. So I ended up publishing both my books with the money that was raised through my Kickstarter.
Can you talk about the that's fantastic, first of all.
Thank you.
Not easy to do, to get books published. Could you tell us about the topic of the other book?
The Princesses Only Wear Putaputas is about this girl who goes to India She has gone before, but, you know, you embellish in a story. I said first time. But then, you know, she went there for a wedding, and she just loved everything she saw, especially the clothes. So when she came back to the U.S., this is kind of based loosely on true stuff.
Okay.
She did not want to get out of her beautiful Indian costume. And, you know, it took a lot of bribing to get her to wear some warm clothes under those pretty clothes when fall came. And, you know, the book is based on that. But she's such a tomboy. I tried to get away from the princess image of pink and all of that, but to just show a girl who loves to read, loves to wear glasses, loves to get dirty.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Love that.
So what does your daughter, what's your daughter's opinion of her inspired self in this book?
Oh, she came with me to both of my book launches. She was super proud to be the, you know, protagonist in both the books. And she loves signing off on books. People who come to my market stall, or when I have when I was at the Virginia Festival of the Book in 2017, and people, she came with me for all the book signings, and she autographed the books. She's really super psyched about it.
Great.
And it's one of, or we've already mentioned the other ones. How many are in the series, and what are they about?
They're all about Feifei. I have one more that is published, which is Feifei Says No. This is like a flashback of how when she was 2 years old. I think this is something more which everybody can relate to. All parents can. Having a two-year-old say no to a lot of things without really meaning what they say. They just like the word. It's a monosyllabic word. Easy to roll off the tongue, I think. Mm-hmm. So how the family just cajoles her into understanding when is a good time to say no and when not to, kind of thing.
And one of your websites is priasnowserving.com,
yes,
which has lots of recipes on it.
Correct.
Where can people get your books?
They can get it from priyamahadevan.com. Oh. I have a separate website for my books.
We are going to list that on our website when we post the podcast, and everyone can go to 947wpvc.org, and we'll list it there.
Thank you.
Yeah. So
And you also have that catering. Priya's now catering as well. Where have you catered, Priya?
I have catered for a lot of events. I started off small, for up to 30 people, and now I have expanded. You know, because of my presence in the market, I get a lot of people who love my food who then contact me separately and ask for. I do some catering for the market. For the university. And just word of mouth, really, Nancy. I mean, that's the only way to get around in a small city, I think.
And what is sambar powder and rasam powder? Just to get back to food a little, that's where my focus is. Can anyone tell?
Yeah, sambar is a very staple lentil and vegetable stew that we make in the south of India. And it can be used as a side for dosas that I serve.
Ate one of your dosas.
Yes, you did.
I think you might remember. It was delicious,
Thank you, I have to say.
And then right after I ate it, I was just kind of intrigued, something about you, and who knew that you had all these things going on. But anyhow,
yeah,
it was delicious.
Thank you.
So,
I'm probably going to mispronounce a name here, Priya, but I just wanted to ask you, the spices and the teas and the chutneys you make, you have a label for it. You'll correct me. I'm going to say it's called Suvayana.
That's perfectly right.
What is its meaning, and how do I pronounce it?
No, you pronounced it beautifully. It's Suvayana. It's very phonetic. And Suvayana just means flavorful. And I wanted to use a Tamil word. Tamil is what we spoke. It's my mother tongue. So Suvayana came from the fact that, you know, nobody else had a word like that, a product like that. And also it was it means flavorful, which kind of capsules everything that I am trying to do.
Are you teaching your kids how to cook? How's that going? How's that happening?
My older ones are pretty proficient, I want to say. Both of them are in college, and they have both taken all my powders and spices. And, you know, when they have an opportunity, they do cook. Yeah.
Yeah. When you guys get together, what is that? Okay, you wouldn't give me the staples very exotically, but what is a mainstay when you guys get together? What's a mainstay food?
Nancy, what I have to tell you that we travel a lot. I've been to many parts of the world. But what we do is when we go around the world, food is a big thing, as you know. So I try to pick up a few recipes here and there of things that I really enjoyed eating. Then we come back home and kind of make it our own, just
cool.
Yes, it's kind of sort of like a fusion cooking, if you will. Mm-hmm. And we have a big garden. My husband loves the garden. And he, you know, I tease him, he's the gardener and the chef kind of thing. So we end up using a lot of stuff from our very organic, beautiful little garden.
Well, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah.
Priya Mahadevan, you can find her, you can find all her websites on our website, 947wpvc.org. But Priya's now serving.com. You can go right now if you want and get some really great recipes. There's a ton there. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Nancy, and thank you, Ellen, for having me.
Sure.
It's a pleasure.
Of course. Come back. So, Nancy, I have a news of note.
Yeah.
This is our news of note time.
Be newsy.
Okay. So, I don't know. Usually I'm like on the upbeat, but this one, I don't know. It's a little on the downbeat. But Philip Alston is the UN special rapporteur. So he just reports back, is going to make a report to Geneva next week. And so he is going to talk about extreme poverty and what has been found. So, basically, he has said that Trump administration's policies have worsened the state of poverty in the United States. We're not surprised that now there's 40 million Americans live in poverty. Many of them are children. 18 and a half live in extreme poverty. But some of the surprising things are that the World Health Organization reported that life expectancy is lower here than in China now, and that we are the only country in the world not to ratify the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. So there is much more, and there's a lot of implications, but one of the implications of creating poverty and these policies that create poverty by taking things away from the already impoverished here that's going on now is to decrease democracy or to influence democracy in a very negative way. That's my news of note.
Well, it's the future is as bad as that. Those tax cuts are probably right up this report's alley, I would imagine.
Do you have one? Oh, go ahead.
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the U.S. government's top consumer watchdog and top regulatory nemesis of the White House, has scrapped all of its advisory boards, which were formed after the financial crisis. The existence of these boards is mandated by law. It's mandated to convene twice a year to do their job, diverse experts in touch with communities, not the lobbying industry, advise on the consumer's behalf. But it hasn't met since Mick Mulvaney, who's in charge and can't stand it, its outspoken critic, took over. He fired all 25 of them, and he is going to restaff the place with those that are serving the lobbyist needs. I'm shortening it. I'm done.
Okay. Yeah. So next time, I promise to have a positive news of note.
I know you, Nancy.
I know you by now. So our next guest, we are very happy to have Leanne Carver here with us. She is from the Maxine Platzer Lynn Women's Center, a hub of social justice, mentoring, and education for students and the community. The center is known to some as a place to turn for professional counseling, yet their work runs deeper, providing respected middle school mentoring programs, training women leaders, legal and veterans clinics, supporting global nonprofits involved in social justice, and they also provide robust internship opportunities for their students. Welcome to the program, Leanne.
Thanks for having me.
So that is a lot of work that you do. What brings all this together? And describe the center and its mission, if you will.
Sure. The center is, as you said, in two parts. So we do provide counseling services that are available for the university and for the local community. And we are also a significant provider of leadership opportunities for UVA students who want to be engaged with the community. And so I think the students' movement across from the UVA grounds into the community is, in a sense, the thing that bridges what those two parts do for all of us together.
How do you, Leah, how do you get the community to be aware of what it is you're doing in the university?
That happens in a few different ways. So here, locally here in Charlottesville, there is a lot of crossover between the local community and the university, in the sense that the size of the university within the community here is large. The university is a major employer of people in Charlottesville. So in some respects, communicating about what we're doing to UVA students, and especially the university's staff and its faculty, helps us a lot in carrying the word out farther into the community, as there's just a really high number of households within the Central Virginia area who have someone in their household that is affiliated either as a student or as an employee with the university, and working word of mouth through those households out into other parts of the community is a big part of how we communicate about what we do. There's also an exceedingly robust nonprofit sector in Charlottesville, and we have community agencies, in particular those that serve a lot of women, who are important partners of ours in keeping all of the folks who are part of the nonprofit sector informed about what everyone else in the nonprofit sector is doing. Is a big part of how those services really reach the people at whom they are aimed. And that's certainly the case for us and for local organizations like SARA, the Sexual Assault Resource Agency, and the Shelter for Help and Emergency, and the Women's Initiative, especially being agencies that we keep in really close contact with. And our staffs have a lot of back and forth between how we can all make sure that all of our populations are served.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to come to a break right now. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. We will be right back to talk about more in depth a lot of the really interesting programs that the Women's Center is engaged in. We will be right back. This is Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We are talking with Leanne Carver from the Maxine Platzer Lynn Women's Center. And just during the break, Leanne and Priya had a chance to chat a little bit. Tell us about what you guys were talking about. I know you were thinking about some coordination between the two groups, and tell us about that and why that's important.
Well, it's a pretty interesting time, I think, for women in our country and for women in the state of Virginia, and for women in particular in Central Virginia. There's a tremendous swell of energy for many different causes, all of which are important to women. So we see organizations like a couple of the ones that Priya is involved with here locally, really building up what they are doing and engaging more and more people from more different segments of our community in efforts to make it a better place. And there's a lot of opportunity to help each other out with that. So thanks for having both of us here today so that we can, you know, not only connect with your audience, but with each other.
Yes, our pleasure.
Leanne, before we went to break, you were mentioning the partnership you had with Women's Initiative, for an example. I was just wondering what sorts of stuff are you doing with them?
Sure. The most important thing that we do with organizations like the Women's Initiative happens really in the background, where as providers of mental health services in the community, of which they have become a really important one to underserved communities where consumption of mental health services is not typically encouraged, and they're really doing a tremendous job of reaching those people. So the portion of the Women's Center's staff who are providers of counseling services are in regular contact with staff at organizations like the Women's Initiative, as well as being in constant contact with other providers of mental health services within the university itself, so that we can help each other to do the best possible job of meeting the tremendous need that is there for those services. So case management is always an ongoing issue for all of us who are providers, and keeping in contact with each other helps those referrals to get made and to get received so that everyone can be served at a place that's suitable for them, both in terms of whether they need to pay or how much they need to pay, or whether they can access services for free, but also whether they need to be seen, you know, through some place that is more easily accessible to them, geographically speaking, or whether they need to be, what can best be seen by someone who has a specialty in the services that they provide. So, for example, within the university community, the Women's Center is known for counseling clients, many of whom are students, but not all, who have been sexually assaulted. Or the other areas that our counselors focus on are serving clients who have relationship challenges, relationship violence, or stalking or harassment that they've experienced, as well as things that are just common within the young adult population that we focus on. So anxiety, depression are some of the other factors that are commonly seen in our client base, and other providers have other points that they focus on. So that network of providers keeping in touch with each other and ensuring that people are seen at the place that can best serve them is really important.
And I read that the National Domestic Hotline statistics that said that specifically people between 18 and 24 carry a very high risk of sexual violence. And in fact, in general, 1 in 6 U.S. women and 1 in 33 men have been the victim of an attempted or completed rape in their lifetime. And that every 98 seconds, an American is sexually assaulted. So I know the services are so important and underreported.
That's right.
Yeah. So very important service. And we focused a lot on that. And I think a lot of people know the Women's Center for that very important work that you do. And you do so many other things, like the mentorship, men's leadership project as well, as well as Young Women's Leaders Program. Why? We can get into what those are, but why are those things so important, do you think?
They're important to us for a couple of reasons. They're important to us because part of what we have been tasked with by the university is to provide those opportunities where students can engage in classroom work that also has a practical component for them. So the University of Virginia has a long history of attracting students who really want to take a deep dive into leadership opportunities during their time in college. It's one of the things that's UVA is a standout in terms of the opportunities that students have to really take on true, meaningful leadership roles while they are there. And we are just one piece of that. And we are one of the pieces of the leadership landscape at the University of Virginia that extends the most from outward from grounds into the local community. So that's why it's important to us as a University of Virginia office to provide programs like Young Women Leaders and the Men's Leadership Project for both what it does for our university students who get to carry out that mentoring and for the benefits that flow to the middle school kids and their schools and their families from the mentoring that's provided there.
So tell us just a little bit about Young Women's Leadership Program, for example. I know that's a big one for you.
Absolutely, yes. So of all of the opportunities that we provide for that coursework and practical work pairing that we do with students, Young Women Leaders is both the longest running and the largest within the different opportunities that we provide. The Men's Leadership Project is in many respects structured, modeled on what Young Women Leaders had been doing for a good 10 or so years before the Men's Leadership Project was started. So the Young Women Leaders Program is a partnership that the Women's Center has had for now a little over 20 years with the Curry School of Education. And it is a mentoring program that focuses on middle school students. So the students are 7th or 8th grade students. And most of us, whether we like it or not, can remember what middle school was like and what that stage of our own development was like. And it's pretty easy to see how having someone who is a little bit older, a little bit more experienced, and highly focused on helping you could be of tremendous benefit both to that individual student and to the whole classroom, the whole school, the whole neighborhood of which that student is a part. So this program was founded by Winks Lawrence, who is a well-known Curry School educator, and a woman named Kim Roberts, who was a graduate student at the time that they worked together to found this program. And it has a few features that distinguish it from other mentoring models. Primarily, it is group and individual mentoring working together. And so much of the mentoring happens right there at the schools, which when you think about the fact that the age group it's serving is middle school, the fact that part of the mentoring takes place within the school itself is one of the keys to how successful these programs have been, mm-hmm. because peer relationships and just navigating what school is like for adolescents is such a huge challenge for them. So to have college young women and young men coming into the schools and working there at the school with students who have been identified by school personnel as kids who have a lot of potential but could use some additional support to reach their potential. So it's a really robust program with curriculum that has been informed by Curry School research and is continually assessed and retooled, informed by that research. And to have a network of support for the university students who can rely on not only the faculty, but also each other, as there are at all times in the programs students who have been involved with the programs in a prior year, as well as students who are new to the program. So mentoring a 13-year-old boy or girl is a pretty challenging undertaking for someone who's 19, 20, 21. They have a lot to offer to that relationship, but they need a lot of support to do it well. And so that's why those programs are designed with the classroom component, with the new and returning mentors design, and with the group-based as well as individual-based mentoring happening. And it happens each group and each pair of big and little brothers and sisters is together for one whole academic year.
Fantastic.
Well, it totally makes sense. That would be a 20-year program. It should go on forever. I mean, that sounds amazing.
It's pretty wonderful.
I'm sorry?
It's pretty wonderful, I have to say.
Yeah. 'Cause who doesn't remember those years? as far as the leadership development for students in other ways, aside from in middle school, empowerment-based counseling, are there other venues for students that they can do that?
Absolutely. On the sort of coursework and practical work pairing front, we also have a good handful of other programs in addition to Young Women Leaders and Men's Leadership Project, where UVA students are involved in coursework that is taught by staff at the Women's Center and that engages them in a curriculum where they learn about effective advocacy in the classroom, and then they are also mentored by other members of the Women's Center staff who have particular areas of expertise, and they conduct public health campaigns, they conduct advocacy campaigns, they conduct marketing and a variety of efforts along those different themes, themes like gender violence prevention, themes like body image and awareness of risk factors in young adult populations for disordered eating and exercise, and how those things can be improved within the culture of the university and the culture of our country, really, of women's bodies being seen as something that should be a certain way, is a challenge that we all grow up with here and that we all have to come to terms with, and that can be a real drain on the resources and the potential of each new generation that faces that as they grow up.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like a whole show right there, perhaps. We can talk about that. And you also have a legal clinic. I know you have a law background yourself.
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
Go ahead.
I'm a proud alum of the University of Virginia Law School. Uh-huh. So
you have a legal clinic?
I'm not a practicing lawyer.
Right. A veterans clinic, legal clinic, and you train interns with those programs,
right,
as well.
So, yeah, that's one of the modes in which our interns are engaged off grounds. So the legal clinic nights that we host at the Women's Center, the actual legal information is provided by attorneys from firms in the area who volunteer their services to provide that expertise. And we have a staff member and a couple of interns that run that program. That's one of the programs that we have that runs all year round. It's not just an academic year-based program. So they are connecting people to information about common legal challenges that folks in our community face. And there are general purpose legal clinics running all year round at the Women's Center that folks can sign up for appointments for through our website. But there also are, as you said, a couple of specialty clinics that that team has developed over the past couple of years where they are offering a couple evenings a year where the advice that is provided is more specific to a certain theme, such as veterans benefits being one and transgender rights being another.
And I do want to mention your website, womenscenter.virginia.edu. You're all over social media at UVA Women's Center. So thank you so much, Leanne Carver, for being here. We really appreciated it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you should come back, talk more in depth, if you would.
Anytime.
Okay. Nancy. It's time for the palate cleanser.
Okay. I feel like we need to supersize that, man.
I know, we need to cleanse our palates. So I have something kind of interesting. 33 scientists published a peer-reviewed paper this March that said that octopuses are from outer space. They said it was from a virus that crashed to Earth in a meteor impact. A lot of people have challenged this so far, even though that was published
they
in a journal. Yep, but I just wanted to get to some, the reason there are other theories like that about octopuses is because they're really strange and very, very intelligent. They have blue blood. Humans do not, by the way. They're so smart. They can use tools, solve puzzles. They have three hearts. They can regenerate limbs. They have no bones in their head, so they can squeeze through tiny spaces. And this is really fascinating. Two-thirds of their neurons or brains are in their arms. So even if their arms are cut off, they can move independently to escape. But this is the thing. This is why people die from trying to swallow live octopus arms, only to find that the arm is still fighting back. Reported 6 people die this way on an average each year in South Korea. So I brought back a theme from today's show, food. And the moral of the story is do not eat octopus arms.
The moral of the story is these octopus are going to need paperwork to stay in this country. That are that's what I heard. If they're from outer space, they're going to need paperwork to stay. He's going to kick them out. We're going to lose this menu item.
All right.
Now that you've brought it to our attention.
No. What do you have?
I have, there's officially an island in Finland where no men are allowed. It's one company called Super She. They've taken over a Finnish island to create a girl power utopia. The Super She is a networking organization dedicated to connecting women while letting them explore the world, and now they have purchased this island this month. They now offer this ultimate, HQ. On the coast of Finland in the Baltic Sea. There's guest cabins and spa amenities, etc. So you go there to recalibrate with no distractions, and apparently one of those distractions they mean would be men. Anyway, it's supersheisland.com.
All right.
There's your ultimate clubhouse.
And I wanted to mention our theme music is by Springtide, but something more important, you wanted to say something, I believe, about Twitter.
Yes, we have not chatted up. AOS Radio, our Twitter handle, and AOS Podcast, our Facebook page. And here's my incentive for people to go there is to tweet us or comment on Facebook. Let us know the corrupt venture you think will push Pruitt out of office. If you have nothing else to say, if you don't want to compliment us on our show, that's not why we ask you to go. Just let us know. What is it? Invent it, create, or make it real, whatever you want. But what will get him out of office?
I know. Right. It is unbelievable how many things he's done.
Yeah.
Next week, we have Tavola chef and owner Michael Keaveney. We're going to discuss food, of course, but also the impact of Anthony Bourdain on the restaurant industry. We'll also have the Reverend Tracy Howe Wispily, musician and theologian. Remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. Thanks, Nance. Thanks to our guests, Leanne Carver and Priya Mahadevan. See you next time.